is rather similar to some things that Matt was mentioning. And maybe I'll even start with that just so that to make the connection with Matt's talk. Although it, while it's similar, it happens in a very different space over and has a very different meaning, but it's a similar problem. So in that sense, it's sort of interesting. Not yet. Okay. So let's hope it works now. That never helped. Okay, here we go. So all right, so here is a picture of an actual event that was measured in ATLAS. ATLAS is one of the larger detectors in CERN, Geneva. It's probably the largest detector ever built. And this is, of course, a digitized version of the event, but this is not simulation. This is an actual event that happened in the detector. And what I'll do in the next 15 minutes, because we all want to go to lunch, is give you an overview of what does it take to understand that event, what part of that event we are really interested in, what part of that event we are not really interested in, but we need to understand, and we'll see how those pieces come together and what parts we need to compute. So what is the most basic thing that we want to compute in particle physics? In some sense, it's a triviality, is the scattering cross-section, right? What we used to call d sigma. And it's some sort of a differential that I'll tell you exactly how to compute in a moment. But this is the most basic entity that we want to compute. We want to be able to understand what happens when you take two protons and you smash them together at 70 eV. Okay, that is the basic question of particle physics. Well, there are others, but this is one of the most prominent questions. And we'll see how all the computations go into computing this sort of differential cross-section. So we don't really have any other way of computing this cross-section in general, aside from Feynman perturbation theory. All right, and that perturbation theory is telling us that this differential cross-section is related in some very definite way with Feynman diagram that we write down. Okay, so let's see what a definite way is. It's basically something like 16 pi over S, and S is the energy of your incoming particles. So here I'm starting to draw Feynman diagrams, but those are very pictorial Feynman diagrams. So S is basically the square of the energy that goes into your event. Okay? So that's just some factors that any child can calculate. And then there is a matrix element square. Right? What? That your children cannot calculate? That's, oh, of course, it's the sentence of arrogance, right? But but seriously, I mean, here there is no issue. The issues are all starting in the next two things that I'll say. So the matrix element is computed diagrammatically, and I'll say more about it in a moment. But very generally, this matrix element is some function, is some analytic function, okay, of the different momenta that you have in your event. Okay, P1, P2, P3. And we are working in four dimensions. This is real world. So those are four-dimensional variables which are constrained to live on their mass shell. Okay, so very generally, it's some very high-dimensional analytic function of all the momenta. Okay? And once you square that, you multiply it by some phase space that is basically integrating over all the possible values that those momenta can take. Okay? And there are very many problems connected with the computation of this matrix element, and there are some problems related to the computation of taking this integral, okay, which is basically related to this phase space part. That's why I said that this part is child's play. So this is the basic entity that we want to compute, okay? And let's see one specific event. Let's look at one specific event. So here is a very, very simple event. It's a QQ bar. So, you know, protons are made out of quarks. And when you collide protons at very high energies, what you're actually colliding are the constituents, the quarks. And in this picture, this process, the quarks happen to annihilate into some vector boson in the middle. That can be a gluon. Most likely it is a gluon or a Z or a photon, what have you. And then they disperse into two other quarks. Now, this is just a single matrix element. In real collisions, the most prominent collisions are actually much, much more complicated than that. Okay, there are many, many Feynman diagrams describing them. Well, the simplest process, 2-2-2, even for the simplest process, which is 2-2-2, this is not the full story. There are several other diagrams that contribute. But at some level, this is not even the problem. At some level, the problem is that perturbation theory for the strong interaction is not good enough at lowest order. This is the lowest order diagram, but there are many other diagrams I can write down. Right? I can also write down this diagram at second order. Or I can write this diagram. Or I can write this diagram. So there are many, many diagrams once you go to next order. And even next order is not good enough for perturbation theory to be good, because this is strong coupling. Well, it's not that strong, but it's strong enough to that first order perturbation theory is simply not adequate. Okay, so part of the computational problems that people are trying to attack is exactly to do these Feynman diagram computations. Okay, and so now there are now packages that do it at tree level. Okay, even at tree level it gets complicated. And there are now many tools that people are trying to develop to do those computations at loop level, where things get really messy. So Feynman diagrams in general, if you've never thought about it, the number of diagrams you have to consider grows faster than exponential. It grows like a factorial or something, even worse, I think. So this is one problem that people are trying to attack in high energy physics, how to do those computations. Okay, and at least at tree level, there are now programs that if you tell the program, and if we had some more time, I could even show it to you in real time. You will tell the program what process you want to compute. Let's suppose I want to compute something a little more complicated than that. Let's suppose I want to compute quark, anti-quark, annihilating into some other particles which are known as the top quarks. And those top quarks will decay into some other particles, which are known as bottom quarks and leptons. Okay, and as complicated as this diagram may look, it's actually completely calculable, and people now have automatic code that does that. Okay, it will compute it for you. You just have to specify what is your initial state, what is your final state, and the program will find all the possible permutations that will start from this initial state and will give you this final state. Okay, so that is a soluble and soluble problem that people have already. Okay, so this is one basic and big field people are trying to understand, is how to compute what we call the hard scattering. Now, even if you after you've done that, you're not close to be done. Okay, this is just the hard scattering. This is not what you actually measure. Certainly not when we talk about quarks, because quarks are not asymptotic states. So the next thing is that you have to include all the radiation that may happen. When you accelerate particles, in general, they radiate. And so there is electromagnetic radiation, which you can compute at perturbation theory. But there are also QCD, quantum chromodynamic radiations. And those radiations are much more difficult because the coupling is stronger. Okay? And you might think that there is some double counting because you're already doing it here at some level, and that's true. There is some amount of double counting. And this is part of the problem, is that there are certain things that are much harder to calculate at this level, and so you do it with the radiation theory, but at some level you have to match, and that matching is difficult. Okay, but that's a technical detail. That's another piece of the computation which you need to do, but it's doable. Okay? The next thing you have to do is that those quarks in general are not stable. Okay, so they will decay, just like the top quark decays. And sometimes you want to do it exactly. You want to compute the full quantum mechanical amplitude. Okay. But sometimes you say, I don't care about all the interferences that may ensue. those are small effects, and I will just truncate them, and at that point, it just becomes a stochastic process. Okay, but you have to do this stochastic process, and you do it in like most codes do it like any other stochastic process. You have some probability distribution, you just sample the distribution. Okay. That is what's called a parton shower evolution. So aside from the decay, there is also, once you produce the final partons, those partons are stable, and they themselves will start radiating. Okay. And quantum chromodynamics give us a very exact prescription for how those things will radiate. And most of this computation can be done on a piece of paper, but the actual simulation has to be done with a computer. So on a piece of paper, you can write down what is the distribution functions that you need to sample over, but the sampling is done over a computer. Okay, so again, what you end up computing at the end of the day is some sort of distribution function, and your computer samples it. Finally, even that is not what you actually measure. What interacts with your detector are hadrons and pions and kaons and all those fancy particles, and you have to have some sort of prescription that tells you how to go from the partons that you produce, which are not asymptotic states, into the things that actually interact with the detector. And there is a lot of complexity that goes into that, but it's not actually very interesting. I think from a computational point of view, it's not very interesting. It's mostly just modeling. You have to model how the parton tears into a hadron, and that's just, you take it from data. So I don't want to delve on that too much. Now, where does the connection with what Matt said comes in? It comes in when we go back to the original stage of just this thing, just trying to do that part, and to compute that scattering, you have to compute a scattering cross section, right? And as we said, you have some analytic function that is a function of all the different momenta, and you have to sample it over phase space. This is very akin to what Matt said, that you have some posterior that you want to calculate. And the way you calculate this posterior is that you integrate over the nuisance parameters, the things you don't care about. But your likelihood and prior are some functions of those nuisance parameters. And they have some peaks, and they have some features in them of those things that you're trying to integrate over. So a wise way of integrating is identifying those features and making sure that your algorithm is converging on that. This is precisely what happens here. What are those features? Those features are when particles go on shell, right? If you write a general quantum mechanical amplitude, that amplitude becomes very, very large when the particle goes on shell, right? It's basically it basically goes like you have a pole in the momentum, right? It basically goes like p squared minus m squared. Okay, and so people try to develop algorithms to exactly pinpoint those poles when you do the integration over phase space. Otherwise, you'll be wasting a lot of your time sampling parts of phase space which are completely uninteresting. Now, from a computational point of view, what you're actually doing here is some sort of a Monte Carlo over a very, very high multidimensional space. So in principle, in general, it cannot be done in an efficient way. Sorry. It cannot be done in a reasonable amount of time. But if you're clever about what part of phase space you're sampling, then you can actually get it to converge in a finite amount of time. So this is the part of the computations that is done on this level. Okay, it's basically a clever Monte Carlo, the Monte Carlo over many dimensional space. All right. So are there any questions on what is the basic problem of the people occupied? We're all on the same page. This is just scattering. Okay. So it turns out that even that is not enough to compare to experiment. Because those hadrons and kaons and all those wonderful particles that you computed interact with your detector in some highly non-trivial way, all right? So you need some sort of simulation that tells you how to take all those hadrons and all those other stuff, and what does it actually do in your detector? Your detector does not say, oh, that was a kaon, oh, that was an electron. Your detector is basically a bunch of matter that responds to electromagnetic radiation, it responds to electron, it may respond to pions, protons, and the response is different depending on what you deposit into it. And that's not something you can do on a piece of paper, you need simulations. And again, from the computational point of view, I don't think it is that interesting. It is just very difficult. Okay. So the way they do it is that they know how the detector responds to certain isolated things, and so they can start to develop some idea of what to expect from different particles. But ultimately, this environment is so messy, the LHC is bringing us to such high multiplicities and high energies that you cannot trust that the simulation of your detector really corresponds to what you thought, you know, 10 years ago. You have to find ways to constantly retune your detector simulators. Okay, but this is extremely complicated. This is where most of the computational time goes into. It takes about between 2 to 15 minutes to simulate a single event, and we have millions and millions of events. Okay, so this is where most of the difficulty lies, and that's why they have so much computing power. Well, that's why they would like to have so much computing power. So I promise to keep this short, and I've already been talking for 15 minutes, so give me one more moment. Let me just summarize it for you, tell you how you go from theory to experiment, because that's how we eventually make the comparisons. Let me just mention one thing, just to make it very clear. What we actually are interested in terms of new physics, in terms of discovering new particles, new forces, is really only this part. It's really only the hard scattering part. That's where we expect to find new physics. That's why I said that much of those other things, like the detector simulator, the evolution of those particles, the parton showering, all those things, the things that we have to do because that's what we measure, but we actually at some level don't care about them that much, because most of the physics is here in the new particles that you may produce in hard scattering. But, well, life is tough. So here is how you go from theory to experiment. You write your hard scattering process. You write down the amplitude for it. You simulate it. You Monte Carlo all the possible outcomes. Then you run it through a detector simulator. So at the end of the day, as we said, you'll have hadrons, pions, photons, electrons flying all over your detector. And you have to take all of that information and produce some sort of detector. How will the detector respond to that? Okay. Then you have reconstructed objects that you actually, in your code, you call electron and photon and what have you. And your analysis is some trivial if this, then that, if this, then that. The only non-trivial part of this analysis is that more and more now people use neural networks in identifying particles and identifying events. So I'll give you a very simple example. One of the particles that were discovered in the 70s and was actually a big surprise was the tau lepton. The tau lepton decays in a very particular way, and it's not a simple decay. And if you try to identify the tau lepton in your detector, it's in general a difficult problem, right? It's not an obvious signature. So what people do is that they design neural networks that neural network's purpose in life is to identify tau leptons, okay? And that's one sophisticated way they try to go forward. And there are extensions of that and complications there, but that's in my eyes, the most interesting part from the computational point of view of the analysis. Okay, finally, there are interesting things in statistics that you do. The statistics, taking the statistics that you're learning from and producing a plot like that, which tells you how much something is excluded, is actually not as trivial as it used to be. That was mentioned a little bit in Matt's talk. The problem is that, yes, you have the theory signal, and you have some, you know how to do the statistics for that. But you also have to take into account all the systematic effects that have to do with your detectors, your fake rates. How many times a proton fakes a photon? Right? As crazy as it may sound like, protons do that sometimes. So you have to take into account all those effects, and that goes into this huge prior and likelihood function that you have to do what Matt said to integrate over, and that can be very, very costly. So usually what happens is that you throw Monte Carlo toy models and just accumulate statistics with Monte Carlo. And that's, again, computationally, it's straightforward to understand what you need to do, but to actually do it is very expensive. So let me just end there because lunch is imminent, and if you have any questions, I can tell you more.
Yeah. How large are the largest networks that are analyzed by a computer, for example, or?
What is the maximum number of final states we can compute?
No, the number of vertices in a state.
The number of vertices
would take into account.
The number of vertices is directly related to the number of particles you end up with, because in your randomizable field theory, the kind of operators you have is very limited. So, never mind what that means, but there is a direct one-to-one relation between how many vertices you have and how many particles. And the number of final states we're talking about is usually, right now, if you want to compute the full quantum mechanical amplitude, I think it's probably no more than 10 to 15 final states. But that gives you an order of magnitude of how many vertices there are. And the real problem is that for some processes, this is OK. And you don't need much more than that. And often there are also approximations that you can use. But for the hard processes, like quantum thermodynamical processes, which form the majority of events at the Large Hadron Collider, this is far from sufficient.
So are the detector simulated tools and analysis tools only available to like members of CMS or members of Atlas, or are there publicly available?
Right. So that's a very contentious question, in the sense that most of it is not available publicly, which is a shame. But so let me say the following: the software that has to do with computing that is by and large publicly available. The software that has to do with the collider or detector simulator, that's by and large not available. It's a proprietary software of the collaboration. People have written mock-ups of those simulators, and those mock-ups are by and large pretty good. They're not exact replica, and it's probably not something you can use for an authoritative paper, but it's good enough for understanding.
So do people use those publicly available tools to write papers? I mean, is it good enough to?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
But it's not good enough if you run the experiment and you want to say something about it. And this is actually something that was something I was trying to talk about, which is recast, which is an idea that we're trying to develop of exactly bridging these difficulties, that most of the software that you would actually want to have an authoritative result is not publicly available. And it's a little more difficult than that. Even if it was publicly available, it's not clear that you will be able to use it in the same way that you can use CMP data, which is highly processed. Because they will not spend the time to process their data. So the data is, by and large, as it is, will be completely useless to you. But that's not a computational problem. That's a sociological problem.
Is there any connection between LIGO and CERN in terms of similarities in politics?
Not as far as I
think it's going to make all data available, whatever, 2 or 3 years. Jeff can probably tell me more about that.
Yeah, I don't think the plan is finalized, but it's being worked out. There, the NSX are going to require the data to be released on some time scale after a proprietary period.
Okay. Is that the same case with the detectors?
So, I think within a few years we will see a change like that. At the LHC. I've heard people now seriously discussing that. But it's not even clear that will resolve the problem. Because the data is so complicated. Because by NSF rules, they are not required to process the data. They're just required to give it to you, to make it available. They're not required to make it nicely available for you.
These stocks happen in climate change.
It costs them a considerable human power to make it nicely available for you, which they can resist.
Now, you talked a little bit about using neural nets to try to suss out maybe non-obvious signals.
Right.
Which, if you have a large confidence that such a thing happened, means that it's obvious, just not the basis that you chose to look at your data. But since you don't know what that basis is, that's why you're using a neural net, how do you deal with systematic uncertainties and whatnot? Are there major concerns over when somebody says we saw this particle at this level, whether or not that was a meaningful signal?
Yeah, there are. And so by and large, no one would trust a statement that is brought about singly by a neural network. most analyses that are done at LHC are done with several different methods. And some of them use neural networks, but there will be complementary analyses which just use objects that you understand of the systematics well. So it's basically just a bunch of if and not statements, if-else statements. So that is the most trivial answer to the question. But it is a concern that people have in mind. In neural networks, you know, you get an answer for, and you know, God knows what went into the answer, right? And it's hard to do the systematics exactly because you're confronted with objects which you have never measured before. You've never measured before photons at 500 GeV. So, but the only thing I can say to reassure you is that people, by and large, don't trust those things, and they have several methods. Okay, thank you.